Among book lovers, it can be a little bit of a controversial issue, paper or plastic. That is to say, have you fallen in love with the convenience of an e-reader, or do you refuse to give up on the tactile pleasures of a dog-eared paperback? Officials in Bexar County, Texas, have clearly chosen the digital side of the argument. They've decided to open up a new bookless library. So what does a bookless library look like? How does it operate? Here to tell us a little bit from the point of view of San Antonio is San Antonio Express Newsnet reporter John Gonzalez. Welcome to the show, John.
Good morning.
Also with us is Carol Diedrichs. She's director of the Ohio State University Libraries. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you.
So, John, this isn't the first bookless library, as you've reported, but it's still among only a very few, and it's not even built yet. But
right.
But what inspired the idea in San Antonio?
Well, the city of San Antonio, big metropolitan area, has a system of about 25 public libraries. They're all inside its city limits. But Bexar County is a much larger geographic area. It's about 1,200 square miles compared to about 500 there in Franklin County. So it's a huge area that there's large parts of it that aren't served or are included in the city, and so they aren't necessarily served by the public library system of the city. So there's huge suburbs that have to come in and sort of use the services of the city, and sometimes it's maybe 20, 30 miles from to the nearest library. So Bexar County, as its own governmental system, has never had a public library system of its own. So it decided to create one, and from the start, it's going to be bookless. So that's one thing that makes it unusual.
Is bookless necessarily more affordable?
I'm not really sure how that's going to work, but I can tell you it is going to be expensive. They're going to have to spend at least a couple of $1 million just to have a nominal collection of classics and, you know, just regular titles of literature and reference and that sort of thing. And that's with the advantage of having free overhead in a county-owned building. Probably some other people might know more about how much it costs, but I expect it's expensive.
So, Carol Diedrich, e-books and a bookless library per se, I know you don't prevail over one necessarily, but there's big parts of it now that are, isn't necessarily cheaper.
Indeed, it isn't. In fact, digital information is often much more expensive, and then the technology to make it function properly is more expensive, and it takes a lot of people to get it in, keep it working.
I was going to say, this isn't about fewer librarians either.
Absolutely not.
John, is part of the deal that people will have access from their computers to the library, that they won't have to necessarily go there?
Right. Initially, they're going to start with one storefront, you might say, and that's to serve a particular part of town where it's basically a prototype, a test. But the system will soon envelop the entire county so that anybody with a computer who registers into the system will have access to the complete collection.
What is it? Do you have any idea what it's going to look like?
Yes. Design has been compared, well, at least the vision of it is supposed to resemble, in the words of our county judge, an Apple store. It's going to be a lot of computers, tablets, and any number of ways to interface with the databases, but also plenty of personnel to help people with their research.
Ohio State's William Oxley Thompson Memorial Library cost $108.7 million to renovate a few years ago. It was completed 3 years ago. And the building features enhanced technology, including more than 200 computers, at least at the time it did. But you kept a lot of the books. And there's something about that walking into a library. Maybe it's a generational thing, but it's very comforting to see all those beautiful books, even though any time I've been in the library, I haven't really gone to use them.
Well, we do have 6 million physical volumes at OSU, and 3 million of them live on our central campus, but 3 million of them are stored. And they are still used, but we do have still have all those 200 computers and a lot more space for people now.
Some librarians wanted to do away with the book stacks tower in the renovation because they thought it was obsolete. So this is something that definitely librarians, as in general, support.
Absolutely. And if you could see the renovated building, the stack tower has been clad in glass now, and it makes a beautiful see-through. It's safer. The books are still there, and they inspire people. They're still used. It's been a great compromise to keep
the tower. It's a familiar. It's a bridge to the future. What John Gonzalez is describing is a leap and a bound.
Absolutely. And for a public library, you kind of have two constituencies. One is those folks who can't afford a device. And so being able to come to a library and use the material inside the library is really great, even though it's bookless.
My guests are John Gonzalez. He's a reporter for the San Antonio Express, and also Carol Diedrichs. She is director of the Ohio State University Libraries. If you have a question or comment about the bookless library, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. John Gonzalez, what's the local reaction been?
Well, it's almost entirely positive. Some people thought that it might be rushing things a bit because it kind of the proposal came out of nowhere, because the person who proposed it got the idea while reading Steve Jobs' biography. But anyway, it's a sudden thing, and they pushed it through, and it was approved for like a $2 million funding already in just a matter of days. But I think the public is embracing it because there's a big literacy issue here, dropout rate, the neighborhood is the first library is going to serve could definitely use more books in any form. Mm-hmm. So it's generally being received well.
And it's probably a community that doesn't have parity in terms of access to technology.
Well, that's for sure. And the free devices, or the loaner devices that you can take home, there's supposed to be dozens and dozens of those. That's really going to be different.
You know, speaking of free, of course, nothing's free. And we've talked a little bit about money and the $2 million and so forth. Did anybody raise any concerns about maintaining the state-of-the-art technology that it will require?
Well, you know, that's really the great unknown here, because there's a lot of contractors that are making themselves available with different kinds of packages and different durations for their contracts. And so we're not sure exactly how much they're going to have to pony up to really get into the game. But obviously there's some big companies out there that sell this stuff.
Carol Diedrich, I mentioned that you started out with 200 computers when the renovation was completed in 2009. Is it stayed at 200? And what about that issue of maintenance and keeping it up to date?
It is still at 200, and our students often don't like to carry those laptops all day, so sitting down at a computer is great. They've already been replaced once in 3 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And how much did that cost?
I honestly don't know offhand.
Off the top
of my head.
You blocked it out.
Exactly. But we do have a budget that is built to refresh them on a regular cycle every 3 to 4 years.
Beth in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Beth.
Hi. I have two questions to kind of piggyback on what was just discussed. Some of the branches here that just don't have that kind of money. I mean, and I know that I heard something on NPR about the book publishers not really feeling comfortable about trying to figure out how they're going to, you know, is there going to be an expiration date? Are there going to be a certain amount of licenses on the books? And then what's going to happen to some of these librarians?
Okay.
And I'll take my comments off the air.
Thank you, Beth.
Okay.
Carol Diedrich, what's your experience been?
That's absolutely true. It's a big public policy issue for public libraries. They're used to buying a book and being able to loan it forever as long as they keep it. Some of the new publisher models expire, and some of us read historic work, and that's going to be a problem long term.
And then as far as the librarians go, librarians, we talked about it earlier, they're embracing this, but they're also being trained. This isn't what we're thinking of.
Absolutely. I would guess that if anyone's like my own husband, they want to take their device into the library and get a little help, particularly those of us less technology-oriented, get a little help from a librarian about how do I download those books onto my device.
Because how are we defining a library these days anyways? We grew up and it was a place you went to read books.
Absolutely. But if you came into our building, you would see students having 3 or 4 devices in front of them, a book or two. It's a very different place, a lot of community space and inspirational space to know that they're studying there. That's why they're there.
I was just reading, I think it was For Better or Worse, in the comics this morning, and she's getting a new job at the library, and everything she's describing has nothing to do with books. Leo in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Just
my question has to do with fair use rights. So when, you know, someone goes to the library today, they may want to take an excerpt of a book, or they may want to print out a couple of pages or something. How's that going to be handled in an all-digital library with, in particular, DRM, which may even prevent, you know, something that then goes into the public domain from being used? And I'll take my question offline as well.
Thank you, Leo.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
That is a pretty challenging piece of it. Fair use is primarily for educational use, but many of the DRM, the digital rights management pieces, are built into – publishers are still being very conservative. One of the models we might explore is the music publishers have gotten more liberal, so we hope our book publishers will too.
John Gonzalez, did issues like this come up in the debate, or the was there a debate?
Well, I can just mention that as part of the design of the first prototype here, there is an inclusion of a copying center, and they said that really everything is going to be free to, you know, at least out of pocket expense, except for copying. So there must be some consideration being given to that, but I don't know the ins and outs of copyright law.
In copying, what you mean is taking something from an online source and and keeping it.
Right, printing out some version of it.
Wouldn't it be just like you have to source things just like you do with the printed matter, Carol?
That would be true for a book, which a person can take to a copier, and as long as they follow the rules, everything's fine. But the digital rights management is built into the ebook, which can prevent you from printing if you don't have those rights assured in your contract.
Okay. 614-292-8513. We have a few minutes left. If you have any quick questions, what going forward? You said you've kept several million books out still that you can see as soon as you walk into the library. But going forward, long term, Carol Diederich, is that the plan?
Well, we do think it'll be a long time before we don't have printed books. We still buy 40 to 50,000 printed books, even though we have an ebook preferred policy, which means we'll buy an ebook first. Often the print comes out before the ebook does, and certain categories, art material in particular, is not yet rendered in digital format as well as people prefer.
So you'll still have
books for a good long while.
With the pictures, ironically.
Yes.
Oh, well, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. Carol Diederich, she is director of Ohio State University Libraries. Also, John Gonzalez. John, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Gonzalez is a reporter for the San Antonio Express. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The inauguration is wrapped up and done, and maybe you've had a renewal of hope. But Pulitzer Prize winner Jeffrey Eugenides says words sometimes aren't enough.
You can shout and sloganeer about hope all you want, but it won't matter. Hope isn't wishful thinking. It's full of requirements.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope the next 4 years, next time on Marketplace from APN.
And Marketplace is tonight at 6 on 89.7 NPR News. 10 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine and a high of 15 today with pretty cold wind chill values, as low as 12 degrees. Clouds for as low as minus 12 degrees. Clouds tonight, a low of 4, and some snow showers with a high of 22 on Wednesday. Support comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. John Clayton's world premiere of Sweet Rosa celebrates the courage, dignity, and legacy of the mother of the modern civil rights movement, Rosa Parks, through music and dance, January 25th and 26th at the Lincoln Theater. Details and tickets at jazzartsgroup.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Far from a household name, Ultrabooks were released by several PC manufacturers last year, 2012, and intended to compete with Apple's almost impossibly thin MacBook Airs. The idea for the thin, lightweight Ultrabook laptops, however, did not come from the PC manufacturers themselves, but from instead a semiconductor company called Intel. That is a household name. Sales of the new devices, however, have not come close to the Apple rivals. Here to talk about the history and future of Ultrabooks is Sean Hollister. He is the West Coast editor of the technology website, TheVerge.com. Sean Hollister, welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Thank you to be here. Thank you for having me here.
Just the name Ultrabook denotes something pretty spectacular. What was the original goal with these, besides, of course, it competing with Apple, but competing how? Just in size and shape and weight?
It's actually never been about size and shape and weight so much as it's been about responsiveness. That's the word that Intel likes to highlight, and that's the terminology, basically the buzzword here for making a laptop very, very quick to respond to your actions, quick to turn on in particular, quick to boot up. When you touch something, it should activate right away. Responsiveness is the word that they like to use. And they also want to make it thin and light and so on while they're at it.
But so the competitive edge was going to be responsiveness.
Yes.
Intel was behind the move, which suggests that Intel had some push and pull in the computer industry, which of course it does. Tell us about where it fits in, even though it doesn't actually make the computers.
Well, it's a rather interesting place that Intel has in the market, actually. Like you say, they don't make the actual computers. They make the silicon chips inside. They make processors for the general-purpose computing that run the different applications. Of course, you know that there's Intel inside many of your computers. Mm-hmm. They also make wireless modules. So when you have when you connect to Wi-Fi, often it'll be an Intel chip inside that does that. Their power comes from the fact that these chips are very desirable, but also that they are a prime force for marketing computers. You see the Intel Inside ads. You see these Ultrabook ads on television. They have a lot of clout there that manufacturers want to take advantage of.
So what happened with the Ultrabooks? Why didn't they take off like Intel intended?
I believe that it's for a couple of reasons. First off, originally when the Ultrabooks came out, the computers were, like you said, designed to compete with the MacBook Air to some degree. Mm-hmm. They weren't quite to the quality standards of the MacBook Air in terms of the way they feel and the amount of processing power and the amount of quality you get for the money. Apple not only builds a stellar product at this point, but it does so for a comparatively low price, so that you can get a MacBook Air for $999 or $1,199 for the 13-inch model. And the PC models, the Windows Ultrabooks that could compete with that across the board on quality typically cost a little more. They couldn't compete with Apple's economies of scale. Even with Intel behind them.
They cost more and didn't have the same quality.
Yes, and that is starting to change, I believe. But
so they're going to stick with it. They're going to push it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Intel has shown that not only are they interested in keeping this going, but they're going to make it more strenuous. They're going to push the computer manufacturers even harder to build computers that people will want to buy above and beyond a MacBook Air. The idea traditionally was, you know, if you're going to spend $1,000 on a computer, why not get a MacBook? It's got everything that you'd have in the Windows Ultrabook. The only thing you've got to do is you've got to figure out how to use this different operating system, which many people weren't familiar with, so that could be a stumbling block. But now the Windows computers are going to have touch screens as mandatory for these new set of Ultrabooks. All the new Ultrabooks coming out this next year, they're going to have the touch screens. They're going to have this wireless display technology to beam things directly from your computer to your television. You can imagine, you know, sending video or photos and so on right over to your television without any intermediate connection. These kinds of things, they're hoping, will tilt that balance in the favor of these Intel Ultrabooks.
Of course, the touchscreen idea will work really well with the latest generation of Windows and be very popular there. But I think that you wrote that it's unclear that consumers even care about that.
Yes, it's a little unclear. I know that anecdotally, when I've spoken to people, they are very, very divided about the new interface of Windows 8. This division between the touch side of it, where you've got these nice what they call Microsoft calls live tiles, mm-hmm. which are these tiles you can interact with on screen that'll continually update with new status updates from your friends and your new calendar appointments and things like that. Between that side of things and the traditional desktop side, where it's more difficult to touch things because they're smaller. You know, you're used to using a mouse pointer in that interface. When I've talked to people, they're very divided about whether it's a good thing that they have these two different interfaces they have to deal with now.
As far as the responsiveness goes, I wanted to go back to that for just a minute.
Yes.
Sean Hollister, were they responsive enough? Were they much more responsive than the Apple product?
I wouldn't say more responsive than the Apple product. I'd say that they were on par, which is something that traditionally Windows PCs had not been. There's a component inside these computers, and I don't think many people are aware of this, but a component called the hard drive and a new version of this called the solid-state drive. The hard drive is magnetic platters that rotate around. There's a physical arm that reads these data that's been magnetized onto these spinning disks. And modern computers are beginning to shift towards solid-state drives instead, which use a much faster memory that doesn't need to physically have any moving parts. So it's for one thing, it's more durable. You can toss around a laptop with a solid-state drive in it, and you wouldn't damage the data on it the same way you might with a magnetic drive. But more importantly, it's extremely quick. It makes everything faster because it was, for the longest time, the bottleneck that was keeping computers from running quickly was that their storage simply wasn't fast enough to keep up with the rest of the computer. With the MacBook Air and the new responsive Apple laptops, Apple said, we're going to use solid-state storage exclusively from now on, so we have no more bottleneck in our computers. On the Windows side of things, it wasn't so clear. Some manufacturers would build solid-state drives into their most expensive computers, so they'd be nice and quick. But the majority of consumers buying a computer, they'd say, my computer is slow. I don't know why. Maybe it's because it's Windows on there. And because, you know, if you look over at the Apple side of things, they're all quick. So I'll go buy an Apple computer. Intel is trying to change that by mandating computers have a certain level of responsiveness so that the Windows ecosystem becomes more viable across the board.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher, and my guest is Sean Hollister. He's West Coast editor of the technology website, TheVerge.com. We're talking about the Ultrabooks, the MacBook Airs. If you have a question for Sean Hollister, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So is the solid-state issue part of what makes the MacBook Airs and the Ultrabook laptops so light? Or how do they make them so light?
Yes, that's an interesting question. Magnetic storage and the solid-state storage, aside from being quicker and the solid-state being a little more durable, doesn't really make a huge difference in weight. It's also a toss-up in terms of how hot they get. So if you hear, it's so much cooler with a solid-state drive, sometimes that's the case, sometimes not. When it comes to the thinness and the weight of these machines, that's about the build quality of the materials. These, for instance, a MacBook Air is made of a aluminum shell. They call it a unibody aluminum because it's actually cut out of a single piece of aluminum, which makes it very rigid. They don't have to build in a very detailed supporting structure inside of the laptop because the shell itself is a single strong piece of aluminum that wraps all the way around. With some of these Ultrabook products, Intel is pushing the manufacturers to do things similar. Some of them are made of, again, this unibody aluminum. Others are a sandwich aluminum process, but still where if you look at any one large piece, it's pretty much just a single strong piece. Some of them will use things like carbon fiber. They'll have glass-infused plastics. So they actually have fiberglass distributed throughout the plastic to keep it stronger. There's magnesium alloys and all kinds of materials that are making them lighter and stronger and allowing them to become thinner as well because you don't need as much metal as you do plastic, or as much reinforced plastic as you would crummy plastic, in order to keep these laptops solid.
Are laptops absolutely where we're headed long term, or is there still going to be a place for the PC anyway at home?
You mean a desktop PC?
Yeah, desktop. I'm sorry, yeah.
Yeah. So what I've heard from futurists and what I believe myself is that it's definitely going to matter less what the device you're physically carrying around looks like because screens are going to be everywhere and you'll be able to wirelessly transmit things to screens. So it's not going to matter whether it's a quote-unquote television or a quote-unquote computer, a desktop or a laptop. You'll be talking about your small screen that's in your pocket, which will be your phone. You'll have your large, your medium-sized screen, which you'll have at your desk. It may have a keyboard next to it. Maybe you fold it up and take it with you. Maybe you don't need to. Maybe you'll have all of the data in your pocket already with your small screen, so you won't need to carry that medium screen around with you. And then when you've got your large, you know, communal viewing experience, whether it's a projector in an office so you can do your, you know, your teleconferencing, or whether it's your television that you're sharing with your family, your large screen will simply be in that place always. And when you need to use it, you'll just have your small screen beam things to it, or you'll have your medium screen beam things to it. That's how I think it's going to be in the long run. In the short run, I definitely think laptops are still where it's at.
Dale in Columbus, you're on the air with Sean Hollister of TheVerge.com. Welcome. Hi, Dale. Hi, Dale.
Hello, Dale.
Hi, Dale. Dale in Columbus, are you there? Dale. Nope. All right. Dale didn't make it, but he wanted to know, if I understand the description correctly, whether you can install solid state if it can be installed in an older computer.
Yes. Yes. There are many scenarios where you can indeed install a solid state drive in an older computer. It is not necessarily an easy process. It can be, if you know what you're doing. But the first thing you need to do is you need to find out if your older computer has a physical space to hold it. Most of the solid-state disks you'll be putting in a computer are the same size as a laptop hard drive. So if you've got a desktop computer, a large desktop computer, it's going to be no problem. You can fit it right in anywhere. The other nice thing about the solid-state drives, since they don't have moving parts, you don't even necessarily need to put them in a special drive bay with screws and support structures, because you could just duct tape it on the inside. It really does not need to be protected in the same way an old drive did. But the second step is, if you do have a space for that, whether your laptop has a small bay that you can open up and put it in, or whether it's a desktop or what have you, you then need to reinstall the operating system from scratch on that drive to really get the full potential out of it. That involves, you know, you're having an install disk and setting up the partitions and all kinds of things, which you can definitely look up how to do online. But if you just think you're just going to stick the drive in and suddenly have everything speed up, typically doesn't work that way.
And to get just the drive, the solid state drive, how much does something like that cost?
They do vary quite a bit in price. They're getting cheaper, but still a bit of an outlay if you want a good-sized one. Typically, I've seen you can get a small, for instance, like 128-gigabyte drive, mm-hmm, for maybe around $100. Goes up quickly to, say, about $200 for double that, for a 256-gigabyte drive, and $400 for a 512-gigabyte drive the last time I checked. So it's quite a bit if you want to put all of your files in fast solid state storage. If you just want to set it up as a boot drive for your computer, and that's where I'm getting a little technical here, but that's where you make it the main drive of your computer where the operating system resides, that gives you the most benefit, you could put a smaller one in your computer just to do that, and then store all of your important files, your documents, your videos, and so on a separate magnetic drive, which is much cheaper for the amount of storage you get. So you'd still have the responsiveness, and then you'd have your files somewhere else.
All-day battery life has been a big part of the equation. How is that measured? What do we mean by all day, and what is the challenge on that score for the lightweight machines?
Oh, boy. It's very difficult. It's difficult to measure consistently, I should say, and it's also very difficult for these thin machines to get it. As you probably are aware, the thinner and smaller you make a computer, the less space you have for a battery inside. Mm-hmm. And the batteries are not getting much more powerful or efficient over time. This is a technology that's pretty stagnant right now. So pretty much without question, if you have a small laptop, it's going to have less battery life than a large one if you've got the same kind of processor inside each. The 11-inch MacBook Air is not going to get as much battery life as the 13. There's just not enough room in there. As far as how you measure that, though, The idea behind the Ultrabook is that the machines are supposed to deliver 5 hours of battery life. And you'll see manufacturers quoting numbers of 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, even 11 or 12 hours of battery life. But there is no consistent way to measure that at the moment. If they say 12, you might only get 6. You might only get 5. If they say 5, you might only get 2.5 hours in a real-world scenario. Often, in order to inflate those numbers, the manufacturers will measure the battery life of a computer when it's not doing anything, when it's just sitting there. Nobody's typing on it. Nobody's doing anything with it at all. It's just sitting there doing nothing, not even running any applications, just sitting there on the Windows screen. Sometimes they'll also do it when they turn down the brightness of the screen. So the screen is at a level that humans wouldn't even be able to read text on it. It'll be that dim. Or a while ago, with the Windows 7 machines, there was a standard, actually. It was called Mobile Mark 2007. It was a benchmark any manufacturer could run. And when they were using that standard, they would intentionally turn the screen down to a brightness of, I believe it's 60 nits. And I can't really explain to you what 60 nits is, but often the screens that you're seeing right now in notebooks, mm-hmm. for reference, are about 200, 250 nits, 300 okay. nits. So you can imagine that 60 nits is only a very small portion of the brightness that these laptops are capable of.
Into the future, when laptops, well, the way you described it, where it'll be about bringing the data to the screen and the screens will be relatively fixed and you'll just have the data in your pocket, will the relevancy of battery life decrease at that point because you won't be having to lug around, you know, a big screen and have to even deal with brightness and so forth?
I sure hope so. I mean, the screen you carry with you, it will always be relevant for the one that you carry with
right.
you. But as far as the other ones, I'd like to think that it'll be a little bit easier
because of the stagnant nature of the battery.
There's also a possibility that battery technology will improve. That there'll be some breakthrough there, and we can start seeing battery technology improve the same way processors do. Now, that is the nice thing about processors, though, is that they are increasing their efficiency.
Mm-hmm.
So we are seeing small increases in battery life with each new generation of processor from Intel, from AMD, from the ARM companies that put processors in your smartphones like Qualcomm and NVIDIA and Samsung and so on. We're seeing some battery life increases from those as well, but not significant ones.
Well, Sean Hollister, it's been great talking with you. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Ann.
Sean Hollister is the West Coast editor of the technology website TheVerge.com. When we return, Russell Holly from Geek.com will be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On Fresh Air, you can hear interviews that make you see the world in a new way.
Every drink of water you take, every pot of coffee you make is dinosaur pee because it's all been through the kidneys of a Tyrannosaurus rex or an Apatosaurus many, many times because all the water we have is all the water we have ever had.
You just never know what you'll learn next on Fresh Air. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's Fresh Air, it's the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade and a discussion with Carolyn Jones about dealing with Texas's mandatory sonogram law when she had her abortion. Join that discussion on Fresh Air at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And it all began with Dallas and Dynasty and continued with Knott's Landing. Tonight on WOSU-TV, travel back in time with pioneers of television and relive everything from Ryan O'Neal in Peyton's Place to Larry Hagman in Dallas. Watch Pioneers of Television Primetime Soaps tonight at 8 on WOSU-TV. It's 10 degrees. Expect some sunshine today and a high of 15. Support for 89.7 comes from Dr. Ron Linehan, MD, of Precision Pain Care. With offices in Lancaster and Canal Winchester, Dr. Linehan treats acute and chronic pain of the back, neck, and other debilitating pain sources. Precision Pain Care. More at precisionpaincare.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us now, our regular guest, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Welcome, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So I think we've talked about this before, but you wanted to get back at it, and I really got a good look at it now. I still, once again, the name is completely eluding me, the purpose of it. It's called the CST-01. It's being billed as the world's thinnest watch. Tell us about it, because it is very cool looking.
So this one's the first. We've talked about some other smart watches before, and this one's actually not so smart. It's really just a very simple watch, designed to be, you know, very thin, very flush to the wrist, and it actually uses an e-ink display, so it uses very, very little power and can really survive in a lot of different environments without having to worry about any kind of damage. And because the screen is very similar to how you see the screen on like a Kindle, for example, it can be read even in low light situations.
Where you mentioned it's not a very smart watch. In the age of everything getting smarter and smarter and smarter, where do you see a market for this sort of thing?
Well, this really kind of fits more in kind of a tech, really almost a style kind of design, because you see a lot of the smartwatches now, they're really intelligent. They do some really cool things, but they're also bulky. They don't fit well if you're wearing, kind of a tight shirt or a form-fitting jacket. The watches are really just kind of, they're focusing a lot more on function, and that means having room for a processor and storage and a high enough quality screen. The advantage of an e-ink display on such a thin, really it's almost an aluminum bangle that would go on your wrist, is that it's much more form fitting.
What would work really well for me is the fact that when you dock it to charge it, it changes the time or makes sure it sets the time properly. And I can go for entire half years with being an hour off because I don't like to reset my clock.
My car does the same thing. Yeah, I don't ever change the time in my car.
Right, me too. But, so that, I suppose, is one advantage. And it is very big and it is pretty cool looking.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting design, and it's one that it's one of these kind of tech stories that really took Kickstarter really kind of by storm. They started out as a very small kind of concept project, and now they've got a lot of people very eager to get their hands on these.
You know, it's pretty neat, and we talked about this last week, I think, in regards to the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas, which ended last week or the week before. That what Kickstarter has done for small startups that are tech related.
Absolutely, and not just tech related. There have been some really interesting things. People who have taken pilots for television shows and movies and put them on Kickstarter. It's really been an interesting kind of thing to watch over the last 2 years.
Yeah, it's just that with tech, you think everything has to be from a big corporation now because of economies of scale and all that kind of stuff. It is a lot of fun to see what's coming out of that. Let's turn to, speaking of big companies, Redbox, Verizon, their union. Is it a union made in heaven or Hades?
It's really hard to tell right now. It seemed like a really good idea when they first talked about it. Redbox, they started in my area just kind of really simple kiosks, and now they're all over the place, and a lot of people use them constantly. I didn't, when they first, kind of popped up at my local McDonald's, I didn't think they were going to see a whole lot of action. But it's really hard for me, at least in my area, to drive by one and not see someone using it right now. But it's, a lot of people have iPads and smartphones now, and it's, very important to have that kind of digital option. And Redbox recognized that and partnered with Verizon. Verizon's Fios service comes with a lot of digital content. Their on-demand service rivals Comcast and
They offer movies in some cases the day that they're available on DVD and a lot of digital content there. And so the idea seemed really solid that they would create this digital streaming service and that the two kinds of services would mesh together, where you'd pay a monthly fee and you'd get a certain number of Redbox rentals. In this case, it's $8 a month and you get 4 Redbox rentals, which is double the price that you would pay just for the Redbox rentals. It's $1 for a rental if you go up to a kiosk right now.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get unlimited streaming of whatever content is available on the Redbox Instant service through either your iPad or your Amazon service. So they took, you know, any device that you would have that runs either Android or iOS and provided it with this digital service. Unfortunately, the shelves for the digital content are really bare right now.
I mean, it's bad the way you described it. It was horrible.
I've been trying it out for about a week now, and it was you know, the app itself is well designed. You know, it works pretty well. It gives me access to a lot of features, and it competes pretty well with Netflix's app for the iPad. But the content is really just not there yet, and it feels almost like what we're seeing is what Redbox was able to scrounge together themselves, because none of the content that I saw really lined up with what's available on Fios's on-demand service, which I'm also a customer of.
Well, so what are they thinking then if you don't have anything good to pick?
My hope is that this is just, you know, because this is the beta, you know, release of the application, that they're just waiting to plug in more content, or they're waiting for a specific time to get content released by Verizon's partners. Because that's really the only way that this service is going to come even close to surviving, much less competing with just really the massive database that is the things that Netflix can offer, or Hulu Plus, or Amazon, you know, really any of the existing digital streaming services. Verizon's really going to have to come, you know, with a pretty, you know, stable arsenal of video to make it worthwhile, especially since, you know, the Redbox service got as popular as it was because they were able to deliver DVDs the same day that they were released in Best Buy and Fry's and these other electronic stores. And these were videos that you can't stream from Netflix. You can purchase them digitally from Amazon, but it doesn't give you the physical copy. And in a lot of cases, the rental option is only for, you know, the one viewing, you know, where it's you watch it once and then it's over. But, you know, Redbox, you know, keeps the same, you know, kind of digital rental service that you would experience from Blockbusters before they kind of all went away.
Did you write that maybe one of the problems is that Redbox might be in a situation where it's competing against itself?
It's a hard position to look at, really, because, you know, if they offer, you know, this massive video library, then it's really going to be something that, you know, people are going to have to decide whether they'd rather stream it or go and pay that dollar. And then there's, you know, the high definition content to look at. High definition content is going to cost the same for a subscriber if they're streaming it, whereas, you know, Blu-rays from Redbox are a dollar more. So it really is going to be interesting to see, you know, how this company rectifies the fact that they are in some ways competing with themselves.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Right now, we're talking about the union between Redbox and Verizon. If you have a question or comment for Russell on any tech issue, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You said that the app is decent. It works, and it's got a lot of good features, and everything seems to work, but you are limited. It's not available on everything. Android.
It's available on iOS and Android, okay, which iOS is more than can be said for Amazon's application, which isn't available on Android.
Okay.
But Netflix is available on every game console that exists right now. They can stream in the browser. They can stream, you know, really anything that has a screen pretty much has access to Netflix right now. So it's an interesting limit to place on themselves, because, you know, when someone sits down to a computer or to a smartphone, you know, they know that Netflix is available. Whereas even if you go to Redbox's website right now, Redbox Instant isn't available to stream just through a web browser. It only happens on either an iPad, an iPhone, or an Android device.
So a cautionary when is the launch date? Do you think things might change by then?
They haven't given an official launch date, but there's been a lot of information that's come out, and hopefully, you know, a lot of these things are true. The big things that Redbox can do to kind of save themselves is to, you know, to get the content ready. And there was originally something on the Redbox Insta website about pricing for a streaming-only plan where you didn't use the Redbox kiosks at all, which was only $6 a month, mm-hmm. and that would, you know, kind of undercut anyone that's offering a streaming service right now. So it would be a lot more interesting to see that happen, you know, as long as the content is there for people to actually watch. Because right now, there's really just not enough there to justify someone spending a monthly fee, in my opinion.
And then finally, Facebook has launched free Wi-Fi and data calling.
Oh, the free Wi-Fi calling, yeah.
Yeah. What... are we all in a dither over this, or big deal, or is it just for people who have Messenger and doesn't matter to the rest of us?
It's an interesting thing. Uh-huh. It kind of, you know, focuses on the pairing that's happened with a lot of the services that are out there right now. You know, Skype and Microsoft have worked together with Facebook on a lot of different projects right now, and so the Wi-Fi calling is an interesting thing for people who use. You know, just especially younger kids who just have maybe an iPod mm-hmm. Touch that they use for communication on things like Facebook. And this would enable, you know, calling in a lot of those devices where they could, you know, they can call friends. It doesn't cost cell phone minutes or, you know, airtime or anything like that. As long as they are, you know, on a Wi-Fi network, you know, the only thing you're paying for is the cost of the Wi-Fi there. And it's an interesting thing because it competes directly with some of the things that Google's been doing and really just kind of continues the path of these two companies kind of facing each other.
Well, we have a question, an email from Arlen that none of us understand, so we figure you might. Arlen writes, given Moore's Law is starting to collapse and quantum computers are still decades out, what impact is this starting to have on the development and production of tablets, smartphones, laptops, and PCs? So in Moore's Law, we did look that up. It's the observation that over the history of computing hardware, the number of transistors on integrated circuits doubles approximately every 2 years.
So to make sure that I understand it correctly, the question that's being asked is, given the inherent increase in technology and the period of time that we are from when quantum computing becomes a regular thing, mm-hmm. Because it exists in a theoretical form right now, mm-hmm. Whether or not we will. Well, the question that's being asked is whether or not computing from a consumer perspective is going to grind to a halt until quantum computing gets to a point where it is feasible for consumers,
yeah.
I think is the question that's being asked there. And I think that what we're seeing now is kind of that exact convergence. You know, we look at mobile computing and how it's exploded in the last 2 years to the point where we have, you know, quad-core processors in smartphones and tablets. But the computer, you know, as we see it now, is kind of fading into the background. You know, we see laptops being dominant over desktops and so the portable computing, you know, rather than computers getting more powerful, we're seeing better ways to use them, or maybe more intuitive ways to use them. So I guess to answer the question, that's kind of already happening, and that we're not focused on whether or not the computers are the most powerful, but we're focused on what's the best way to use them to make our lives better. Whereas we, at one point, were looking at those two things as you know, as paired, you know, where there was a line that was drawn between the two of them, or we're not seeing that anymore.
Scott and Powell, you want to talk about some old-fashioned technology?
Yes, I do, Ms. Fisher. Good morning. I like your program very much. I've watched it for years.
Thank you, Scott.
You're more than welcome, and happy belated New Year, and welcome back from the Martin Luther King holiday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I have a JVC digital VHS HD compatible VCR. and I have it hooked up through component video into my widescreen TV, and it's coming back in the picture almost a green instead of the normal colors that it should be, and I'm wondering if I should have that professionally cleaned. I do have the JVC DVHS head cleaner, but I believe it's dirtier, too dirty to use that the cassette cleaner.
Russell?
I mean, there's several points of failure there. It could either be the tape as it's being put in, it could be the player itself, or it could be some kind of corrosion or corruption in the cable itself. Any one of those three things could lead to a green, you know, kind of hue when it comes to VHS.
Okay, so check out all three, Scott.
Can you recommend where I can take it to have it checked?
Russell's not from here.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, Russell's from far away in Maryland. So
oh, wow.
I should say that more often.
It's definitely safe to, you know, you're not going to do any harm by trying out the tape cleaner to answer your previous question. It may be too far gone, but it definitely doesn't hurt to try.
Okay.
All right, Scott. Take care.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fisher.
You're
Thank
welcome.
You, Russell.
Have a good one.
Rex in Blacklick, you're on the air. We're running out of time. I wanted to squeeze you in.
Okay, and great show.
Thank you.
Russell, I got a question. Not quite so far in the distance past. This is the last question, but I just recently picked up an HP touchpad, and I just wanted to get your quick opinion as to the WebOS operating system and whether you think the thing's dead or whether it's got any life left in it. Thanks.
It's a tough question to be sure. I'm personally a big fan of WebOS, but it kind of went away. HP's not really supporting it in the way that they used to. There is an open development group called OpenWebOS that is trying to keep the operating system alive, but their progress is fairly slow. So I would look for OpenWebOS. I would search for OpenWebOS. There are a couple of good websites for people that are still maintaining that kind of thing. If you are brave and clever at the same time, there are several people who have taken the HP touchpad and actually installed Android on it, which would give you access to some more modern applications and maybe make the tablet a little faster for you. But otherwise, there's what you see is what you get if you're not willing to kind of open it up and play with it.
Russell Holley, thanks so much for joining us today, as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holley is a tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks to the Allside staff as well. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Corinne Gleckler, production assistants Karim Shaban, Rose Joe, and Leticia Wiggins. Video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Also, Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.